Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. And just to let you know, we are going to be discussing LCs, and if anyone would like to speak on them, whether they were on the panel or not, just sign up over on the side table there if you want to talk. I know I'll probably be calling some of you up, whether you sign up or not, to come talk. But all right, with that, I would like to open an informational meeting on the update on the Oregon Health Authority and our coordinated care organizations. Tina Edlin.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tina Edlin. I'm the acting director of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today to talk about an update on CCOs and where they are, the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. I want to talk a little bit about an extension of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the high-risk pool, to cover people who were in the vulnerable population that were in that program. And then I want to talk a little bit about the mental health investments that the legislature made and how that's going. So to start, the CCO update. Some of this you've seen before. New data will be coming out at the beginning of February, but I thought it was good just to review quickly sort of where we are and what we're seeing in the reporting of the 17 metrics that CCOs are held to. So we have 16 CCOs. We have every part of the state covered, about 95% of the population. We'll have to wait until all the new enrollments till I can look at those and see where they all ultimately land. But as of now, about 95% of the Medicaid population are actually enrolled in CCOs. As you know, they're governed by a partnership of providers. They have consumer advisory councils. They're responsible for outcomes. They're paid incentives for quality and achieving metrics. And their budget rate of growth is capped at 3.4% a year as part of our agreement with the federal government. So what we're seeing so far, every CCO is living within their global budget. The state is meeting its commitment to the federal government to reduce spending by 2 percentage points. On our state level progress for quality utilization costs, we're showing promising signs of improvement. I'll talk about some of that specific data here on the next slide. And just a caveat to this is we don't expect the gains to be linear. We do know that we're going to make some fast front-end gains. We'll probably see some adjustments, but obviously the trend upward in improvement is going to be really important to us as we go forward. So what the early data shows is we have decreased emergency department utilization and expenditures. Visits are down 9%. We've increased primary care visits.
Tina, let me stop you there. I heard anecdotally that with the expansion, with the Medicaid expansion, there was a spike in ED visits. Has that been factored into here?
Senator Cruz, no, that hasn't been. We haven't got that data yet. Okay. We won't start to see. There's like a 3-month lag to the data.
Okay.
So we won't start to see that data until we come in. I will say that the data that showed the spike, the increase in emergency department use for new Medicaid enrollees was collected back in, if you're referring to the Oregon Health Study, it was collected back between 2008 and 2010, well before CCOs were implemented. I would hope that, I mean, I imagine there's some pent-up demand for the new enrollees. We'll see some increases in certain kinds of use. I would hope that what we've done in the delivery system will attenuate some of that.
And I do have a question for Chana. Is this, she's following.
Uh-huh, I am.
This script, is that available for the public or is it online, both?
Chair Monish Anderson is online in Oldis, and if we have extra copies, they'll be back.
Pardon?
There are only a couple copies left over there, but it is online.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, proceed.
Okay. So we have increased primary care visits. Those are up 18%. Again, that's exactly what we wanted to see. We didn't want to see a decrease in emergency department use accompanied with a decrease in primary care. It was really important to see one going up and the other going down. We've seen a drastically increased enrollment in patient-centered primary care homes, significant decreases in admission rates in hospitals for conditions that you really should not, you can really avoid a lot of admissions. Not all of them, but you can avoid a lot of them. Congestive heart failure, adult asthma, for example. Increased adoption of electronic health records. Again, we really believe that we won't get to our ultimate goals if we don't have an ability to share electronic health records. And then a decreased hospital readmission rate. Hospital readmissions are a significant driver of healthcare costs. It's really a community solution that can respond to hospital readmissions. Those are down 12%. Again, this is really early data. This data is actually just the first 6 months. I expect things to shift around and change a little bit as we go forward, but having taken a peek at the first 9 months of data now, the trends are continuing. So that's encouraging. The other thing that's gone on very recently in December, we moved several of the CCOs integrated dental care. As you remember, the goal of CCOs was to have integrated dental, mental health, and physical dental and mental health care. In December, about 240,000 enrollees were put into fully integrated CCOs, so they actually contracted with the dental organizations to become an integrated entity. 10 of the 15 CCOs have now integrated dental services, so 60% of OHPs are now in the fully integrated CCOs. The 5 CCOs that haven't yet, they just weren't ready. They don't have to, according to the legislation, the statutes, until July of 2014. So this is really pretty significant that we have 60% of the population in integrated systems when it still remains voluntary to do so. Any questions about that?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Tina, this is all encouraging. One thing that I couldn't quite get my hands around when Dr. Goldberg was presenting to us is why the lag time on how this breaks down for individual CCO. We have it collectively, but we don't have it per CCO. Why is that?
Senator Shields, members of the committee, that's because we didn't have enough enough of a sample to really have reliable data at the individual CCO level. For some of these measures, you get into really, really small numbers, so we made the decision to wait. I actually think that we'll see progress data in this next report in February. I will double-check and get back to you on that, but that's my understanding, is that we'll be reporting by CCO in this next report.
So you have the data. You just felt like it wasn't...
We wanted it to be as reliable as possible, yeah. And at the statewide level, you get some reliability, but at the individual CCO level, except for the very big ones, of course, you know, but for the smaller ones, you don't.
So do you have... Okay, follow-up. Do you have it for Multnomah County, for example, for both family care and health share?
Senator Shields, members of the committee, yes, we do.
Can we get that?
Yes, you can. Yes. Yeah. The reason I hesitated was because what we have done is every month again, it's part of our quality control process, because these things, you know, you're writing code basically to pick this data out of a large data set. So every month what we do is we share with the CCOs what we're seeing in the data. They get back to us to let us know if they're seeing something different, if they've run the code and they're seeing something different in their data. We shouldn't be seeing anything different. But it's a quality control check, because then we can get together and say, okay, we're picking up this case and you're not seeing it. Why aren't you seeing it? And we've been able to really improve not only our scripts but the underlying data as we've gone along by going through that process. So the reason I hesitated was I wanted to make sure that loop had been closed before I'm releasing data. So
Madam, I would appreciate, and I'm sure the whole committee would, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. breakdown. Certainly
happy to do it.
For Multnomah County, I would like the comparison of all these numbers, mm-hmm. family care versus health share.
Okay. Yeah, happy to do it.
Just send it to committee services rather than to each one of us.
Okay, I'll do that.
And then one last follow-up, Madam Chair. Would there also be numbers for DMAP for those who are not part of...
Senator Shields, members of the committee, that's actually something I would just have requested. Up until now, we haven't requested. That's the fee-for-service population. We haven't reported by the fee-for-service population, and we need to start doing that so we can see it compared to the CCOs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks.
Okay. Another change that's really a result of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act is we've gone to a single benefit package within OHP. If you remember, we used to have the OHP Plus package and the OHP Standard package, and OHP Standard was a fairly skinny hospital benefit. It was lower on benefits or had fewer benefits than the OHP Plus. As part of this change, there's one benefit package now for all Oregon Health Plan enrollees. The way that we currently have about 160,000 new enrollees in the Medicaid program as of January 1st, or actually January 5th. About 42,000 of those came over from the exchange. They were found eligible in the exchange, and the data file was sent over to us. The remaining 118,000 came to us through what we call the fast track process. And what that is people who are below 138% of poverty and are on the food stamp program, the SNAP program, food stamp program, have already gone through all the federal checks. They've all already gone through all the eligibility that you need to go through to qualify for Medicaid. So what we got a waiver from the federal government to send them a letter saying, you know, you get food stamps, you receive food stamps, your income is below 138% of poverty, you're eligible for Medicaid. Would you like to participate? They all have to be redetermined and go through a full eligibility process at the end of their first year. But for this first year, we were able to do a very simple, streamlined process and get people in very quickly. So that explains the 160,000 new enrollees.
Senator Steiner,
thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Ms. Edlin, I heard a really interesting story the other day. It's an anecdote. Okay, I'm not, but I'm interested in. I was at a healthcare roundtable that Congressman Blumenauer was sponsoring, and Jill Ginsburg from the Northeast Safety Net Clinic was talking about one of her patients who came in brandishing the letter saying, I don't know what this health plan stuff is, and I don't want to do it because then I'm not going to be able to get my care here anymore. Mm-hmm. And, of course, she will. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested to know what the department's doing to reach out to people who have not responded. We talked a little bit about this in November, but I'd be interested to hear an update on that. For the people who haven't responded, what percentage of people haven't? Do we have a sense of why they're not responding? That kind of thing.
Senator Steiner Hayward, we did two full rounds of mailing out to the food stamp population in order to reach them. We will right now. There are no immediate plans for going out to the rest of the list. I anticipate that we will use our community outreach. We have community outreach grants that we will use those grants and those community partners to try to reach the people who haven't responded. But right now, it's really, to be quite honest, what we're really focused on is making sure that the people, the 170 or 60,000 that are there, who are there, are enrolled. They're getting their first appointments. So we're working very closely with the CCOs to make sure there's any enrollment glitches are taken care of, and really focused on that. And then we'll turn our attention back to outreach with that population. We also for the issue of people coming in with a letter and saying I don't quite understand what this is. We have several systems set up for CCOs to call us if they're experiencing difficulties, for members to call us to get answers to questions about, I can't reach my CCO, I don't know who my doctor is, those kinds of questions. We have a whole system set up around that. I will say the call volume is unprecedented. We keep adding capacity to be able to answer the calls, but we're going from an average of 800 calls a day, for instance, to over 5,000 calls a day. So it's pretty daunting. It's very exciting. I was just told we have an 8 o'clock call every morning with all the CCOs. We always check to see how things are going, what they're hearing. And this morning they said about 95% of the calls that they're getting, they're flooded as well, but about 95% of the calls they're getting are people so happy to have coverage and so excited that they're going to be able to get services. So,
thank you.
Okay. So that's the fast track enrollment. The next slide, it's kind of hard to see, it's small print, but it really does show the new enrollments by CCO. And it shows the number of enrollments that came to us through the fast track process and the number of enrollments that came through Cover Oregon. Now this number today, this number was 160,000. That was as of yesterday, as of the 13th. So 2 days ago, the number today is up to around 162,000. I anticipate that it will continue to grow. We estimated that by the end of this biennium, we'd have around 240,000 new ACA enrollments. The question we
have...
How much? About, I think the estimate was about 240,000 by the end of the biennium.
Madam Chair.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Senator Knoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, we've been receiving contact from independent brokers, insurance brokers, that some of their clients are being inaccurately put into Medicaid, even though they don't qualify. Have you heard those complaints? And if so, what is being done to ensure Oregonians and taxpayers that only people who qualify are actually getting into Medicaid?
Senator, not members of the committee. I actually saw that same report, and I think it was I think it was seven applicants, and but five of them turned out to be accurate, if I remember correctly. But we do have. I actually have called our Medicaid director to find out exactly what the audit mechanisms are within the Medicaid program to ensure accuracy around enrollment. As she's actually getting back to me sometime today on that, and I can get back to you about that.
Further question, as it relates to OMIP, I've been told that a significant portion of OMIP folks are undocumented, and yet Cover Oregon sent them the application for enrollment in Medicaid, and I know that you've done some extensions. Do we have any accurate information as to how many of those have enrolled, and are they... is everybody eligible that has enrolled from those applications?
Senator, members of the committee, for the OMIP population, what we had to do is we had to add a couple of screens that we didn't have to use for the people who just came strictly through the fast track program, and one of them was a citizenship check. So that we did check for citizenship at because that's one of the fundamental rules in Medicaid is that you must be a citizen. So yes, we did check that for the OMIP population.
Further question. So you didn't have to be a citizen to be an OMIP, but you do to be in Cover Oregon, which is Medicaid.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Senator, members of the committee, OMIP was financed through a different mechanism. It was financed through assessments on carriers and on premiums paid by the individuals, so it doesn't come under the same kinds of rules as programs that are paid for the way that Medicaid is, financed the way Medicaid is. Okay. So the question always arises about access when you're putting this kind of volume of people into the system. What kind of access will they have? And I'm not going to pretend that access is going to be perfect all over the state. We know there are areas of the state that struggle with access right now, but we have put in several pieces as part of our health system transformation that we think will help address this. And that's what this next slide is about. That first of all, there's a misconception that everyone just coming into coverage didn't have a source of care before. We know from the Oregon Health Study that about 50% of the uninsured population actually had a usual source of care through an FQHC or some source like that that didn't require insurance. We have a strong network in this state of federally qualified health centers to serve this population. We started a loan repayment program for providers who are willing to serve in underserved areas and serve the Medicaid population. We the tax credit program is in place to incent providers to stay, actually, to keep providers from leaving. And then we are really looking at other kinds of care, team-based care in patient-centered primary care homes really should help. It shows that it helps alleviate the burden on the primary care physician, the primary care provider, and puts the team at work. We're looking at alternative or what we call traditional health workers, how we might use community health workers to broaden capacity to primary care in the state. So none of this alone is obviously is the complete answer, but we think it puts us a long way toward making sure that we have the access we need. The temporary medical insurance pool, I think this is, again, the high-risk pool was it's a program that was ended statutorily. It was ended as of December 31st of 2013, and that was really because of the implementation of the ACA and the fact that people couldn't be denied insurance because of previous conditions, that we all thought the need for the program wouldn't exist any longer. But with the challenges with the health insurance exchange, it was really pretty clear that this was a group of people who are really vulnerable. They have high risk, and they might not be getting into the exchange to get coverage. So with legislative leadership, collaboration between OHA and legislative leadership, we looked at our ability internally to create a temporary program, which we did. It will only exist out until March 31st, the end of open enrollment, and basically gave everyone in OMIP the opportunity to enroll in it. They have to pay their premium again, but they can enroll in this program. Right now, today is the last day for them to pay premiums, so we don't have a clear picture of how many of the 10,000 OMIP enrollees will actually come into the temporary program. But we do know that about 20... I might have these numbers just slightly reversed, but I think it's about 2,500 have come into commercial insurance through Cover Oregon, about 2,300 into Medicaid. There's some portion that we know from the phone calls we've made that have gone directly to the market, directly to the commercial market themselves, not gone through the exchange. So the real number here is probably somewhere less than half of the total OMIP enrollment are going to participate in the temporary program, but over the next several days, once this deadline passes, we'll have a much better idea about that.
And we have the Senate will be introducing a bill extending the benefits of the enrollees in the OMIP program. And do you want to just comment on that?
So what we really needed to look at, again, we have the ability under current law to create this kind of a program. It's obviously it's the financing mechanism that becomes an issue, and so that's what we would be looking for legislation around, was to give. We have a few options that we've thought of that could possibly be used for financing this new program, but also giving some flexibility under the new reinsurance program, giving the board of that program some flexibility if they wanted to address this issue. So that's the kind of thing that we were looking at. But none of that is completely sorted out yet. Okay.
Yes, Senator Cano.
Madam Chair and Director, it seems like we're going to have a significant hole in the OMIP population. Do you know what percentage of the 10,000 is undocumented as of the end of the year?
Senator Knopman, I'm sorry I was mispronouncing your name before.
That's all right. Happens all the time.
Members of the committee. I actually don't know the answer to that. I can find that out, though. They had fairly good statistics on their program, so I'll see if I can find that out.
That would be, Madam Chair, that would be great to have because currently they don't qualify for Medicaid or cover Oregon. So is it my understanding, I guess, is that the only way that people who were in OMIP, who are undocumented, the only way that they could receive insurance is through the private market. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And what help have they been given to get to the private market to receive coverage?
Senator Knope, I don't know the answer to that question. I can find that out as well.
For the question, mm-hmm. Will we be able to track that population to see if, in fact, they do end up with insurance? Because it seems like the alternative is that they're going to show up at emergency rooms. Because I don't know any other way that they would be able to get coverage if they don't go through the private market. So, will we be able to have statistics on what happens to that population and does that increase the emergency room visit issue down the road?
Senator Knope, members of the committee, off the top of my head, I can't think of a way that we would necessarily be able to follow them in that they, it's much the same challenge we have in trying to assess how many of the whole 10,000 have actually gone to the private market. We're, like I said, we've been making these phone calls to ask people, what have you done? You know, we don't get a hold of everybody, but, you know, a lot of people don't return our phone call, oddly enough, because I think it's because they've, you know, they feel like I've taken care of business, I've found insurance, you know, I don't have to report back to you that I found insurance. So I mean, I think there's an element of that. So I don't know if we could. I mean, we'll be monitoring what's happening in emergency rooms in terms of just volume, but I don't know that we'll be able to follow that particular population.
We have about 5 minutes.
Okay. Okay. So the last item, and I'll just do this quickly, is the investments in community mental health. The 2013 legislative session basically put $40 million forward to invest further in community mental health in this state. The allocations were about $3 million for promotion and prevention, about $25 million for children's mental health, and $22 million for adult mental health. It's really to fill in the gaps. This has been an incredibly, you know, underserved area that's really been seen as increasingly important. It drives a lot of costs. It drives a lot of need in the state. Those decisions, the Addictions and Mental Health Division did was put together an RFP process and had organizations compete for the dollars. About 85% of the funding decisions have been made so far. It's really across the state. The impacts will be across the state. They should be announced. I mean, fingers crossed, they should be announced by the end of this week, so that I can't really talk about who and where the dollars are going until we're done with the procurement process completely. But it's very encouraging to see the reaction and the response that we got and the level of new investment out in the community. With that, I can take questions.
I'm very excited that we have so many more people getting health insurance that didn't get it before. And I think that everyone needs to keep that in mind because we know that with health insurance, there's better health outcomes. And my concern, though, because we have so many more now with health insurance, that the program will be sustainable. How is the health authority addressing that issue? I know we're early on, but when does the federal money stop at end of 2014?
Senator Mona Anderson, members of the committee, the federal dollars associated with the waiver go through 2017. Okay. The new population that's coming in is 100% federally funded through 2017. Then it declines every year until 2020 till it's at 90%, and the federal government funds 90% of the cost of the new eligibles from that time forward. So it doesn't go below that 90% level. Part of the approach to sustainability obviously is what we're doing with coordinated care and really trying to find savings and trying to, keeping the growth of the budget at that 3.4%. So on a per capita basis. Having said that, no, I think we really do need to pay attention to the out years and what the really watch costs. I mean, that's the reason these metrics are so important, so that we can really be monitoring what's happening to our costs and keep going forward on the kind of transformational activities that we're engaged in and making sure that we're getting the best value for our dollar.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. There's a rumor that there is a bill on the other side of the building for a tax increase to fund CCOs, but you're telling me that you don't need that additional money right now, that we're okay?
Senator Cruz, what I can say is that we're staying within the 3.4% growth. I can say that. And I don't know anything about the bill on the other side of the building.
Okay. An interesting question would be the feds are going to long-term fund 90% of the expansion population, which creates a dichotomy because they aren't paying 90% of everybody else. That seems to me that would be a scenario that might be ripe for litigation because it's an uneven treatment.
That's interesting.
Are there conversations currently going on with CMS about how we justify that unevenness?
Senator Cruz, members of the committee, I don't know of any conversations like that going on. I do know there have been conversations, and I don't know where these will go. I think right now everybody's so busy just implementing the Affordable Care Act that there have been conversations about creating a blended rate. So and they've talked about a lot of different ways of looking at that. And obviously, if they go down that path, we would want to be partners at. We want to be at that table and have input into what that looks like.
Okay. And I would also assume that the guarantee of the federal money is subject to the fact that at some point in time, the federal government might actually pass a budget and change some things as well.
Any further questions? Thanks, Tina, so much for coming. Appreciate it. I feel that health care reform is going in the right direction when you give us this kind of information.
Thank you so much.
All right. With that, I would like the next part of the agenda is to look at some of the bills that we may be considering. The first one is LC 130, the Silver Alert Program, and Senator Knope, do you want to give us a summary, Chana, or just let Senator Knope?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Tim Knope, Senate District 27. I just wanted to introduce for your consideration LC 130. It is the Silver Alert, which essentially is a bill that tries to help us collaborate with our and coordinate with our local public safety entities and agencies and have them have a written plan for recovering adults who have dementia issues or other issues. And the bill is really designed to deal with the significant wandering issue that exists with the dementia population. And so that's the first four sections of the bill. The last sections of the bill deal with the Medicaid fraud bill that you have all voted for twice, and so was not controversial on the Senate side. So that is the bill for your consideration, and we have, I think, three excellent people who can give you more details about the Silver Alert aspects of this bill.
All right. Thank you very much, John Bartholomew, Shelley Edwards, and Officer Norm Tolleson.
Chair Marna Sanderson, Senate Health Care and Human Services Committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Alzheimer's Association Oregon Chapter, and thank you for scheduling a hearing on this proposal in January. My organization works to help the all the folks in Oregon who have been impacted by Alzheimer's disease or related dementia across the entire state. And I'm happy to note that since I last appeared before this committee, we have opened offices in Bend and Medford so that we can better serve the folks in Central and Southern Oregon. Statistically, there are about 80,000 people in Oregon living with Alzheimer's disease, and over 165,000 family caregivers, and that's not even just all the family members who've been impacted, but those are people providing direct care. This is a huge issue. We expect the number of people with Alzheimer's disease to grow to 110,000 by the year 2025, and nationally, it has been recognized as the single most expensive disease in America, more than cancer, more than heart disease. And we're doing a lot of other stuff around this to work so that hopefully I get myself out of a job. We just secured the federal budget that Senator Cruz alluded to should be voted on this week that includes $100 million in new funding for research. And so that's some good news out there. But in the meantime, we have a lot of issues at the state level. During our town hall meetings that we did all around the state for the last 2 years, we heard a lot of people bring up the issue of an inconsistency with police and sheriff departments when it came to dealing with people with Alzheimer's disease, particularly when somebody does go missing. And so we looked at other states. There's about 40 other states that have crafted Silver Alert policies, some of which look a lot like Amber Alert. This one does not, but they all vary in some scope. This actually is, again, all about making sure that every police and sheriff department in the state has a policy and a plan on what to do in these cases, and that it should address issues of coordination with other agencies. How do you work with the media to get that help? That's the Silver Alert, the traditional Silver Alert part. And what kind of training do you offer your officers to make sure that they know how to deal with these situations differently than a traditional search and rescue or missing persons case? In crafting this legislation, we've been very pleased to work with Senator Canope, and we've worked with the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and the Broadcasters Association all to get their buy-in. And you should have some testimony in your email, a joint statement from the sheriffs and police chiefs who are living it up on the coast right now at a conference, so couldn't be here today. But in terms of the issue itself, you know, what happens with wandering and why this bill is important, I'll turn it over to Shelley to introduce herself and the issue.
Then we have about 8 minutes left.
Yes, Chairwoman Monish Anderson and the committee. My name is Shelley Edwards. I am the Outreach and Program Director for the Alzheimer's Association Oregon Chapter. I've actually only been in Oregon about 8 weeks. I have recently moved here from the Washington, D.C. area, where I worked with the association for the last 6 years. And in that role, I was working with wandering issues. The issue is that 60% of people with Alzheimer's will wander and become lost at some point in time. And if you take those numbers based on what John was saying, that's between 50 to 60,000 people people in Oregon who will wander and become lost at some time, which means they will be involved with first responders and with the police. We also know that within the first 24 hours, if we don't locate that person, over half of them will risk injury or death. And within the first 72 hours, they over half, 80% will die. So the person with Alzheimer's doesn't remember their name. They may not remember where they live or where they're going, so they may be disoriented even in very familiar places. And there's too many times where we've heard stories where the people were left at home and then they went out and they succumbed to the elements only about 2 miles from where they live, so it's not very far. And we want to make sure that people are safe, and the association has the Medical Alert Alzheimer's Association Safe Return Program, where we also work with police to help locate and connect people. And I just happened to have one happen last night. It's the first one since I've been here that a person was actually found by a police officer who was wearing a Medical Alert Safe Return bracelet, and within 20 minutes we were able to reconnect him with his family. Turned out he was from the state of Washington, but he was in Oregon when he was found. So it's not just an Oregon system, it's throughout the entire country. And law enforcement are frequently called to respond in these cases, and most sheriff's departments and police departments are well trained on what they need to do in a search and rescue and when they receive a missing report, but they don't necessarily have any formal policies or enough training, and that's what this bill is all about. And to talk to you a little bit about some of those experiences, I want to turn it over to Officer Tolleson.
Thank you, Shelley. My name is Officer Norm Tolleson. I'm with the Tualatin Police Department, and I've been a police officer for about 30 years. I've also had the opportunity to be trained as an instructor for the IACP, International Association of Chiefs of Police, in the Alzheimer Initiative Program. And I'm still a patrolman, so that means I get to work on the streets and take the calls. And wanted to tell you folks that having encountered several Alzheimer wandering patients, having a program, having a set standard, an outline for search and rescue, an outline for contact, training the officers how important it is to use certain steps while making the contact is can be a lifesaver out there. It can be lowering the impact on the Alzheimer patients when you do contact them. And having the data compiled, as we're eventually going to get to, I hope, will help us get these folks back home.
Thank you. Question? I have a question for Senator Knope. You know, I was hoping that we'd have a clean bill. I have no idea why the Medicaid fraud piece of this bill was taken out. I mean, what the politics was of why we didn't have a problem here in the Senate, but evidently the House did. And to me, it's extremely important to have the Silver Alert piece of legislation pass. And have you, can you give us any insight as to why the latter part of this bill is controversial and why you decided to put them together in one bill?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we have limited ability to draft bills. Neither one is controversial. I think the House decided that they might be able to play politics with it last session, but I am quite hopeful that they've decided that's probably not a good idea, since both of them are needed. So I think we should let the House decide if they want to play politics or not. But I think we could probably get a 30-0 vote out of the Silver Alert bill and the Medicaid fraud bill here in the Senate once again. So I think we ought to move forward, and I'd be happy, obviously, to have any of you and any of the rest of the Senate who wants to sign on to it to be sponsors again.
Great. Any other comments?
Madam Chair, I'd say I think it's a pretty clean bill the way it stands.
I would just like to say that I admire Senator Knope's and LC's facility with a relating clause on this bill. That took creativity.
Yeah, when they didn't go with relating to the world, we had to... We had to create something else as a relating clause. Okay. Yes.
Thank you. And yes, I definitely would be wanting to sign on onto the bill. I just want to make sure that we can get the Silver Alert piece through, because I have no idea what the dynamics were on the Medicaid process. All right. Thank you very, very much for coming. I really appreciate it, and I think everything is green, at least on this side. For go, I mean. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Let's skip to LC 148 because Senator Beyer isn't here, and invite Gwen Dayton and Sarah Basler from talk to us about drug outlets. And then after these two, Ken Wells and Bill Cross.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of LC 148. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. LC 148 is intended to preserve the current regulatory structure that's already in place for providers who have dispensing authority through their licensing boards and to prevent additional regulation and fees from being imposed by the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy on these providers who already have dispensing authority. This legislation is necessary because the Board of Pharmacy has an opinion from the Attorney General's office that says the Board of Pharmacy has the authority to regulate dispensing providers as retail drug outlets, and the Board of Pharmacy is preparing to move forward with a rulemaking process to use that authority. This bill does not give any provider dispensing authority that they don't already have. Currently, licensing boards have oversight over and regulate their own licensees who have dispensing authority. This LC preserves that structure. Nurse practitioners and the Oregon State Board of Nursing take patient safety very seriously. In Oregon, about 250 nurse practitioners of nearly 3,000 total have dispensing privileges. In order to have earned those dispensing privileges, each nurse practitioner who has them applied to the Oregon State Board of Nursing. As part of the application process, the nurse practitioner must complete a dispensing program that had been jointly developed by the Oregon State Board of Nursing and the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy. When the Oregon State Board of Nursing receives the application from the nurse practitioner, they notify the Board of Pharmacy, and they notify the Board of Pharmacy again when the application is approved. If there's a complaint to the Oregon State Board of Nursing about a nurse practitioner related to dispensing, the Board of Nursing, again, is required to notify the Board of Pharmacy, and in the case of a complaint, the Board of Pharmacy has the authority to go in and do an inspection. The Oregon State Board of Nursing has implemented a number of rules around dispensing for nurse practitioners. It requires that medications dispensed by NPs are prepackaged by a pharmacy or a manufacturer registered with the Board of Pharmacy. The OSBN rules also include labeling requirements and specify that the NP who is dispensing the medication ensures that the patient receives both verbal and written guidance on the medication, including information about side effects and drug interactions. The rules also include requirements around drug storage and record keeping. There's no evidence that there's any sort of problem with the current regulatory structure. In the past 3 years, there have been no complaints to the Oregon State Board of Nursing related to nurse practitioners dispensing. The last complaint about an NP related to dispensing was in 2007. ONA is concerned that additional regulation and fees could lead some providers to stop dispensing altogether and ultimately cause patients a delay or an inability to access needed medications. Many of the NPs who have dispensing privileges are in small or solo practices, and any sort of fee is a real business concern for them. Additionally, many are in rural parts of the state where there may not be easy access to another dispensing provider or pharmacy. We urge your support of this concept to keep the current structure in place and prevent additional unneeded regulation and fees for dispensing providers who are already thoroughly regulated by their own licensing boards. Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz. I'm Gwen Dayton with the Oregon Medical Association. I'm the OMA's General Counsel. My comments are similar to Ms. Basler, so I'll try not to be repetitive. The OMA concurs with the ONA in believing that the current regulatory structure is adequate and promotes patient safety. Like nurse practitioners, physicians are allowed by law to dispense drugs. And in fact, the Board of Pharmacy statute expressly says that physicians and others don't have to be licensed as a pharmacist if they're able to dispense drugs pursuant to other law, as physicians are. The Oregon Medical Board does regulate dispensing, like the Board of Nursing does. There are administrative rules expressly directed at dispensing by physicians, and examples of those rules are in your written testimony. But we, all of us at this table, and I'm sure in this room, care about patient safety. And so we ask the medical board, have you gotten complaints about this? Because if there's problems with it, let's talk about it. We have no interest in ignoring a problem in the community around dispensing. The medical board said, kind of anecdotally, an estimate, if under 10 complaints and of the 800 they received per year. So it's, they're glad to get an express number, but that's their impression, that it was at least under 10. So it's not really been an area of concern for them. It hasn't been an area where there's been complaints or significant issues with physicians. So we support the position of the ONA that this existing regulatory structure seems to be serving its purpose. Physicians have to adhere to the law as expressed by the medical board, and if there are issues with patient safety, we can talk about how the medical board might address them, because there is an existing structure there that we should be taking advantage of rather than adding another layer of regulation when the Board of Pharmacy already says you don't have to be licensed as a pharmacist to dispense. So let's let the licensing boards take care of the dispensing by their practitioners. We think that's appropriate, especially given the fact that there hasn't been a significant problem, at least as expressed to the licensing boards. So with that, I'm very glad to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Actually, it's good because it's a question for both of you. The physicians and the nurse practitioners who do dispense, can you give us a sense of the kinds of drugs that they're dispensing? Because obviously we're going to have a concern. We know about our controlled substance problem, our opioid addiction and overdose problem in the state. So do you have a sense of how many people are actually dispensing controlled substances that might be of concern to us, or what kinds of drugs they're dispensing?
Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of data on what is actually being dispensed. The boards, at least the Board of Nursing, tracks that a person has dispensing authority. They don't track that they're using that authority or what they are dispensing. Anecdotally, we hear most NPs who are dispensing not all that frequently and are not dispensing opiates. They would not want to keep that in their office, but I unfortunately don't have a number who may be doing that.
Thank you. Ms. Dayton?
Senator, I have a similar answer. We know that there's approximately 676 physicians who are registered with the medical board to dispense. That's out of over 13,000 licensed physicians. So it's not a significant percentage of licensees that are actually registered to dispense. Of that list, we don't really know right now, but we're working with the board to find out, frankly, how many are actually dispensing. There might be a good number of them that are actually registered to dispense but don't. And after we find out that number, what are they dispensing? I agree, although I don't have data to support it and want to find it, frankly. I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of controlled substances dispensed out of offices because of the risk. I mean, just keeping that stuff in your office is not a good idea. But that's my impression, not data, and we'd like to follow up with you with those exact numbers.
Thank you. Yeah, I would really appreciate it if by the time we're actually hearing this bill for real, we had some really hard data.
We should contact Tom Burns with the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program to see if in their data they can glean any of that information for us.
Yeah, for the level drugs that are monitored there, they should be able to give us that data, I would think, because we're dealing with, they have DEA numbers, so they're there. So.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So can Gwen and Sarah, can you refresh our memory on the history of why this topic is before us? Didn't this grow out of the extension of dispensing generally from the last legislative session?
We might need to just bring up the Board of Pharmacy and Bill Cross to give us that information, because it came from them. But you can go ahead and respond.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Shields, this issue is coming up now because of the Attorney General opinion that I believe has a date of February 2013 that said that the Board of Pharmacy has the authority to regulate a dispensing practitioner as a retail drug outlet.
Based on that bill that was passed, or is that a completely separate thing?
Sort of a separate thing.
Yes, Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields. It's a separate thing. It was an AG opinion that was requested, and Sarah's correct. It came out in February of 2013. It's not related to any legislation.
An AG opinion, follow-up, Madam Chair. An AG opinion requested by the Board of Pharmacy?
I believe, Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields, I believe it was requested by the licensing boards. Is that correct,
It was
Sarah?
Jointly requested by the Board of Pharmacy, the Board of Nursing, the Board of Dentistry, I think the Board of Optometry, Veterinary Medicine, and Naturopathic Physicians.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Senator Knopf. Well, then I'm confused because, thank you, Madam Chair. I am confused because, Ms. Dayton, when I heard you talking, I thought I heard you say that the regulations explicitly say that physicians do not have to register, but then there's this AG opinion that says that they can be regulated as retail. That sounds like an absolute contradiction to me, and I'm not sure I understand what's going on here.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Hayward, I understand the confusion. Here's how it lies. The statutes in the Board of Pharmacy statutes allow individual practitioners to dispense if they're authorized to do so by the laws of the state. So
right.
You can't just dispense it unless your particular licensing laws. But there's a difference between an individual practitioner who's registered with the license with the medical board, in my case, to dispense, and their office. And the AG opinion says that a clinic. A place where a person practices their office falls under the definition of a retail drug outlet based on the words that are used to define retail drug outlet. So the regulations, I don't want to speak for the Board of Pharmacy, so I'll be really brief. I believe the regulations that they are considering regulate the place, not the person.
So let's call up.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we need to call up Ken Wells from the Board of Pharmacy. As well as Bill Cross.
Chairman Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Ken Wells. I'm a pharmacist member on the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. So, really, I was here to answer your questions and then make any other comments. So I know it seems that you have some, so I'll be glad to field the questions.
I do have a question. Here in healthcare reform, we're trying to streamline and decrease bureaucracy and, you know, that type of thing. And it seems like that if the Board of Pharmacy comes forward with having another layer for our individual practitioners to have to be licensed and register, et cetera, it adds to the cost of health care. And when there's no problem, or at least minimal complaints, I was just wondering why you were thinking that this would be necessary.
Well, we're proposing to register the outlets, not the practitioner. They will still, we have no control over their, if they have the right to prescribe and dispense per their boards, that's still going to be. But what we are is we're looking to register the outlets again, back to patient safety. We're looking at storage, we're looking at supply, we're looking at labeling, we're looking at record keeping. I think a great example was just brought forward when the committee asked, what controlled substances have been dispensed, and the answer from both was we don't have the records, or we don't have that to answer that question. Well, that's what part of the thing is. The records will also show this. So it's not to a way to make it more difficult. It's a way to register that outlet and to prevent any problems in the future. Right now, one of the comments was, too, is, well, we've had no complaints. Well, do the patients are going to their doctor, their nurse practitioner, their physician's assistants to get medical care. Maybe they're not aware that there might be an issue with that prescription because it's all been done internally. It hasn't. And so if you or I have not been told, hey, if there's an issue, please let us know. Also, in pharmacy, a lot of the things we find are when we do our inspections of our pharmacies. And so we're looking to is maybe some of the issues will come out if they are registered and we then go in and do inspections. Maybe it might bring to light some issues with the either the storage or some issues with the dispensing. So it's just, again, we're looking for a constant model for all outlets.
Okay. Well, I know as a nurse, of course, I worked in clinics in the 80s and 90s, and I know that far more streamlined now than they were when I was doing clinic nursing. But we were regulated pretty carefully because I was the one that had to make sure that I was monitoring the temperature of the refrigerator. This was before assistants could do that. The RN was actually monitoring the temperature, and we had to make sure every morning and every night just to make sure that the storage of those vaccines, which I was responsible for, had to be monitored. So I sort of agree with what OMA and ONA presented, that there hasn't been a problem, because I know at least with the Board of Nursing, they really do regulate at least what a nurse has to do. Senator Steiner, Hayward.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Let me be clear. Patient safety is right at the top of my list of important things. I mean, I've been a physician for 25 years, and I pushed hard for a range of patient safety reforms, both before joining the legislature and in my couple of years here. I'm really worried. I really do think it's kind of splitting hairs to say that you're not regulating the physician, you're regulating the outlet. If you got a solo practitioner in a rural community in Oregon, I'm not sure there's much of a distinction between the doctor or the nurse practitioner and where they practice. It's their small business. They're running the place. I don't think they're doing it to make a profit, which retail pharmacies generally are. And I'd like to think, and I don't think we've got evidence to the contrary yet, and I do agree, I've asked Ms. Dayton and Ms. Basler for much more detailed information about what's really going on out there. I guess I'm really worried. We've got a huge healthcare workforce shortage in this state, and it's only going to get worse. And we've got doctors and nurse practitioners and PAs who are retiring because they find the regulation, the cost of malpractice insurance, the et cetera, to be unmanageable. We talked about it this morning in education about the cost of loans, paying back your loans. And adding another layer of regulation, another professional board that I'd be responsible for if I were a dispensing physician, it makes me antsy. It feels like a solution in search of a problem right now. I'm not saying that I could be wrong. I could be wrong, but at the moment, things do come to light pretty well if there's a really major problem, I think. I think people would know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm naive. But I got to say, I'm dubious at the moment about the need for these regulations. It's more of a speech than a question. I apologize. But I need to get that on the record, that I'm worried about having to be responsible to whole other board.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health Pharmacists. And I think, going back a few years, this issue was brought initially to light with the Zoom Care legislation allowing physician assistants to dispense. And under that, the legislature created a path that we concurred with in the sense of trying to distinguish between regulating the professional versus at what point does a dispensary become sort of that drug outlet? At what point should that be regulated by the Board of Pharmacy to ensure certain standards, compliance with certain standards? And since then, I know that the board has reached out to the other boards. We really haven't been involved in that as associations, but they've been trying to develop some rules, and I don't know if there's a way that that process can incorporate, what the Board of Nursing, nurses, the Board of Medical Examiners, and some of the other boards are doing or are, what their regulations actually look like when you line them up to some of the standards, and they wouldn't necessarily be similar, but they'd be comparable in terms of trying to ensure that the products, the drugs that they're distributing are safe and that they're safely stored and labeled properly. And to some extent, some of that obviously sounds like those regulations may be in place. How well they're enforced or what kind of compliance, certainly on behalf of the two professional societies, we don't know. But I think it'd be, I think when we were discussing this, that whole pathway, I mean, that model was a vehicle to move into sort of this evolving area where more and more practitioners were interested in getting into dispensing, and our concern being now you have the prescriber and the dispenser, one and the same person, all happening within the same office. So the need to ensure that errors are at a minimum is obviously important for patient safety. And to that degree, I think we were kind of surprised to see this legislation in, you know, being brought forward in the short session, only because we really haven't been at the table to talk about, are there duplicate regulations, and is there a way to streamline so that maybe they're not having to, you know, have the kind of cost in, or, you know, ineffective kind of costs that none of us want to see.
We need to move on, but it was really important to have your testimony before us, because, well, real quick, because we really are running behind.
We are. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that the board has promulgated at least some temporary, a first set of rules, and I know it's not the final. Is there any way we could get a copy of those? Just to see where it is you think that you need to go with this.
Well, I would say we have right now the rules that the physician's assistants for the Zoom care model that went past. But, you know, really, we have some proposals, but we started meeting in June, meeting with the various boards and the associations, and we started talking there, and we've had three meetings just to try to get this kicked off and so that we all work together and we could come up with something. And, you know, our last meeting, they asked us, well, gee, what's your time frame? So we just kind of gave them what we had this year, and if we pass it in a certain time when we had to go to rules hearing. We're not set to have this thing put to bed and have it, try to have everything done by a certain date. We're trying to get this out and talk. So what we have is what we had for the PA is what I'd say, Senator Cruz. And as far as the rest, we may use that as a template or a model, but we're very willing to look at the single rural location, or if a outlet only dispenses a certain number of prescriptions, if they want to, you know, we've been discussing this at these different meetings as we go along. So, but as Mr. Cross said, we were surprised to see not only this bill come up at this session, but also with the emergency clause to make it immediately effective, in that we've been talking about it for 7 or 8 months, and it wasn't if we were trying to have it done before 2014. So hope that answers your question.
Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Lee Beyer, LC 27, allows private payers to hire home care workers through registry maintained by Home Care Commission, and Alice Redding and Megan Moyer.
And Madam Chair, this is just an informational meeting, but I want you to know that my wife has dispensing privileges. I'd like to get that on the record.
Oh, good. Yeah.
As a conflict.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, which is Central Lane and Lane Counties. And I'm not going to go into great depth on this today. I don't think we are, because what mainly my ask of you is I think that LC 27 will soon become a bill and hopefully will come to your committee. And I wanted to make you, the committee, aware of this. You kind of read the title. What it really talks about doing is allowing Oregonians either like myself with their parents or something like that, take advantage of referral services for home care workers. And using the existing service, the Home Care Commission that we've established in the state, I became aware of this. Frank was working, trying to help make sure to get some care for my 92-year-old father and doing that. And I'll tell you, when we started saying, you need some help, Dad, and obviously he didn't want it, but he needed it. And looking at that and just the process of trying to go through and say, where do you get that, where you're finding somebody who you feel, you know, is going to treat your loved one well and is qualified to do the work and all that. Well, there are a number of individuals out there who are doing this. There are a number of private parties, but you still don't, as an individual, know how to do that if you're not in the business. One of the nice things that I discovered was the our Medicaid program through the Oregon Home Care Commission Registry and Referral Program offers that service, where they do the background checks, they handle the payroll, and they handle all that stuff, and you've got quality workers. And in fact, AARP and in fact the National, the New York Times has recently ran an article saying Oregon's system is the best in the world. And so the question that I think that's posed is, if we got that kind of quality system, can we make that service available to other seniors and their families who are not at the low-income level to fall under Medicaid? I think it's a great system that's there. I think there's some questions that need to go through there, but it's a nice matching up of people who are, you know, frankly, will do this work and want to do this work and do it well, and a system that makes it easy for those of us who have elderly loved ones. We can take advantage of that and feel comfortable that those services are being provided and at a reasonable cost, because it's really expensive, I'll tell you that. So that's it in a nutshell. There will be plenty of time to go through the details of it when and if you get the bill, but I just
not a
to
lot
say,
of
this
time
is an important
to go
thing,
through.
Huh?
Thank you.
And I'm going to depart because I've got a meeting that I'm late for.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
And we just have about 8 minutes.
Oh. Good afternoon, Chair Mooney, Sanderson, and members of the committee. My name is Alice Redding, and I'm from Rainier, Oregon. I've been a care provider for 14 years, and I've helped 10 non-Medicaid consumers for 12 out of those 14 years. It is because of my experience with non-Medicaid consumers that I am in support of the Home Care Choice Bill, because it will improve the quality of the providers available to non-Medicaid consumers. It is important for non-Medicaid consumers to have the assurance of a provider with training and a background check, rather than finding someone they know nothing about. In my community, non-Medicaid consumers tend to find providers through advertising on the community bulletin boards or word of mouth. Their choices for non-Medicaid consumers are limited to how many bulletin boards they can reach, which is made more difficult because of the lack of transportation for some non-Medicaid consumers. It also opens up a vulnerable community to cases of being misled or worse, made victims by providers who have not been through a background check. For example, I know of a non-Medicaid consumer in my community that had a prescription stolen from a person she had hired from the general public and had not gone through a background check. Had the option been available, the non-Medicaid consumer might have opted to use the commission to find providers who've been vetted and trained. This incident might have been avoided. In addition, the Home Care Choice Bill would also help current home care providers be able to apply the hours worked for these non-Medicaid consumers towards their health care. It would also benefit for the non-Medicaid consumer to have the commission process tax deductions on my behalf. Please consider moving forward with the Home Care Choice Bill for the improvements it brings to both non-Medicaid consumers and home care providers like myself. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union. And I just briefly wanted to draw your attention to the packet of information that we provided for you as an introduction to this legislative concept. One of the things I think is really important to know is that home care can be a very effective way of helping people live independently and remain in their own homes. And the Home Care Commission has created a statewide reach. It's been an incredibly successful program, and we are able to serve consumers currently in the Medicaid program in every county in Oregon. And we want to make this available so that consumers who do not qualify for Medicaid or other publicly funded home care can also have that ability to receive in-home care services. There's a map in your packet that kind of lays out the distribution of home care workers, and you'll see in many parts of Oregon there may not even be another home care type of option. And this being able to hire a home care worker through the commission would really create opportunities for people to remain independent that don't currently exist. I also want to make clear that this bill is about choice. This is a care option that may not be for every family, but it is for some, and some people feel very strongly about wanting to have this type of care. This is a client-employer model of care, so it does require the consumer to take on responsibilities of interviewing workers, selecting workers, supervising workers, and hire and fire responsibility. And there's an article at the end of your packet that actually goes through what are the differences between this type of model of care and, say, hiring an agency. And for some people, this is a preferred model, and for others, agency may be a preferred model. And certainly we respect the importance of agency being a choice for people as well. But we did want to give you a little background to understand that this is different than hiring agency, and that it is a model that for some consumers is really preferred due to the amount of control that you can have in directing your care. And last, we look forward to continuing this conversation during the February session and hope that we will get to work with your committee on it. Thank you.
That's wonderful. I was at NCSL in December, and this was a topic of conversation. So it isn't just this state, but with the tsunami of the baby boomers, this is going to be such a great need. And, in fact, there was a model, I think it was the state of Virginia, it might have been one of the Carolinas, but that have worked on a website to, and actually it was half funded by the state and half funded by a nonprofit. Extremely valuable, and a physician actually gave us, who was instigated this, was did the presentation. So it isn't. This is something that's extremely important, I believe, to address the problems that are associated with finding care for our loved ones. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, now we'd like to jump to LC 147, Lynn Bergstein and Dave Sanders. Okay, I want to, yes. Okay.
Chair Monis Anderson, for the record, my name is Len Bergstein. I'm here representing ZoomCare. And with me is Dave Sanders, CEO, co-founder of ZoomCare. I'm going to, David, start off with some comments, if that's okay with you, and then be prepared to answer any questions about this important bill.
Thanks, Len. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Dave Sanders. I'm an Oregon physician. I'm the co-founder of ZoomCare and CEO of ZoomCare, an Oregon company. It's been a pleasure to be here again with you, and greatly appreciate the work of this committee over the years in leading in healthcare reform in the state. As you may know, in many ways, largely a result of your reforms, ZoomCare has been able to build a network of 21 neighborhood clinics now. We care for a 250,000 people in Oregon alone, and we employ over 200 people in Oregon. As you know, we've had, a vision for healthcare in Oregon, where we really see the consumer, we call her Sarah at Zoom Care, at the center of the universe. And we've really tried to move healthcare out of high-cost centers.
Step back a little.
Out of the high-cost centers to neighborhoods. By building neighborhood clinics. But ultimately, we see healthcare really moving from neighborhoods even to workplaces and homes and right to your pocket, if you will, where you carry your smartphone. And that next revolution will require telecare. 3 years ago, Zoom Care began offering telecare visits. We call it takeout. And it's been very successful. In fact, we now care for several thousand people via telecare. And this year, we're going to publish an article that was co-researched with OHSU. They're our joint research colleague on this. And it will demonstrate a high level of efficacy and safety for patient care via telecare. But despite this, success and track record, and of course, it's beyond Zoom Care. Providence serves PEB members effectively, military. I'll just share with you personally, I came back from India on Monday, where I was visiting innovative companies delivering health care, particularly though telecare, in remote villages all through India very successfully. So this isn't anything new. It's done throughout the world today. But despite all of that, unfortunately, despite 2 years of intensive work, the insurers do not reimburse for telecare services. So the crux of this bill is a very simple principle. The principle is that the care is the care. The visit is the visit. Whether the care is delivered face-to-face or face-to-screen, the care is the care. And so we're asking their insurance community to reimburse. We're by no means adding any new covered services. Doesn't affect Medicare. Doesn't affect ERISA-based self-insured plans. It really deals largely with commercial health insurance plans and, of course, the PEP and OEP program. So it is not a mandate. It simply asks the insurers to recognize the care is the care and to reimburse for the exact same care they already provide in person. So I want to just call your attention to a couple of just the key elements of this bill, sort of just see the key elements. So I think the first piece to draw your attention to is... Glenn, it's at the bottom of page
two.
Bottom of page two, where really it just points out that that look at line 30 must reimburse a claim for telemedical health service using the same health care service code that applies to health service when provided in person, when delivered in person by a health professional. That's the key idea here in this bill. So with that, I'd like to just to stop my remarks and invite any questions. Thank you for your time.
When I first heard about this, you know, my immediate reaction was, with healthcare reform, we want to try to go to a global budget. We want to not go for fee for service,
yes,
et cetera. So can you? That's my first question. Can you address that issue?
Absolutely. We couldn't agree more. Zoom Care is working very actively in its own business on a range of other models of payment. Here's how I see this: is that let's just look at chronic care, for example. We all know, the research is very clear, the ideal way to care for chronic care is through a combination of in-person visits, telecare visits, email, group care. Yet despite that being extremely clear today, chronic care is reimbursed in America 98% through fee-for-service. What I think will happen here is by here sort of kind of compelling doctors and insurers to begin to be paid for non-in-person visits. It's a first step towards expanding the relationship from traditional fee-for-service care where it's dependent on the patient seeing the doctor in the office. Once we've broken that logjam, I think you'll see us open to kind of more flexible ways of paying for care, like fee-for-solution, fee-for-result type methods that you're seeking.
Okay. The other concern, of course, I have is in the bill, leaving it to the discretion of the physician. I would love to see something added to this bill where there are some standards, and should that be from the boards? I don't know enough. My my fellow physician, not fellow physician, but the physician over here.
Healthcare professional.
Yes, a provider could address that issue. But I know that in instances past, there was a profession that utilization went through the roof. And in fact, it was just one clinic in this state that needed to be audited. And so that's why I'm sort of tending to want to make sure that there's some kind of standard, local, state of Oregon, not national. So do you have a comment on that?
Well, I think our overall view is that we think the current LC has been well crafted, but I fully understand your concern. I think we are supportive of inserting language if you felt that was appropriate.
If I can, Chair Mona Sanderson, we've been working very closely at really your suggestion and other members of the committee with the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. They actually spent a lot of time explaining to me the history of this, the 2009 history and what have you, and they've suggested some language that comes from Georgia and Arizona. Some other states have taken a whack at this this problem. We think there's a way to get language that still keeps the local element that Dr. Sanders is talking about, but addresses the concern that they have it. So we're very much in tune with what you're saying in terms of page 2 and the lines you're talking about are 5 through 7. We are very clear that there's a way to solve that particular problem with language.
Okay, I do want to make put on the record that there is testimony from the Telehealth Association of Oregon on OLIS, and I know I have it in mind. And I also asked the Telehealth Association to give me copies of what the other states have, and one is from the Arizona, but they go with national. But the state of Georgia is doing telehealth and is more community focused. So, yes. Dr. Steiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think your concern is valid, and I appreciate the point you brought up, Chair Mona Sanderson. I guess what I would say is that historically, medical boards and medical associations have not chosen to specifically determine what a standard of care or what's an appropriate way to deliver care. And if you think about some of the other legislation that we've passed, even in my relatively short tenure in this seat, for example, that the uniform credentialing rules that we passed for telemedicine providers last year, we leave it at the discretion of the physicians who have, in this case, physicians, certainly PAs and whatever in your case, Ms. Dr. Sanders, but the standard of care, if you will, evolves, if you will, depending on how things are delivered. And in many ways, this kind of care is already being delivered. If I think about my practice at OHSU, we have protocols in place. If a woman calls in, for example, complaining of pain with urination, and they go through a checklist to make sure that she doesn't have any concerning symptoms, they look at her medical record, and we'll prescribe an antibiotic over the phone. That's telemedicine, and it's done based on what we all think is safe to do as physicians and protocols that we come up with together. And I would think, and Dr. Sanders, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would imagine that your team, first of all, is already providing this care and just not being reimbursed. And second of all, tends to err on the side of caution, I would hope anyway, because these are the kinds of things that we see. I mean, if somebody gets inappropriate care over the phone, whether it's just a triage phone call or something else, we're going to know about it because there's going to be a suboptimal outcome. I worry a little bit about saying this kind of care is suitable for telehealth and that kind of care isn't, because things change over time. And I don't know, I'd be interested to hear from the medical board, from the medical association, from the nurses association,
from their perspectives. The chiropractic board, the naturopathic board. I mean, we're talking about a number of providers.
Just as a concrete example, in our case, you log on to our website, we've limited our care to 30 primary care conditions, just those conditions, and each one has been mapped to a specific care protocol. That's how we deliver telecare. Chair, I mentioned one more thing I want to get to. You just mentioned the issue of overutilization and cost. We currently charge 20% less for the equivalent care because we don't incur the overhead of facilities and extra people when you deliver care centrally through a telecare system. That's just, it's still no volume. As you do it in higher volume, we're going to drive the unit cost down. I expect the insurers will negotiate actively to make sure that we are fully leveraging telecare. So I see this being a very effective cost reduction tool.
I think that, yes, Senator Shields, and then we only have a few minutes, and I want to make sure that Tom Holt and Jeanette Holman get up here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm intrigued by the idea because I think the potential upside is that people who would say, you know, I'm just too busy to go to the doctor, I've got kids, I've got two jobs, I just,
absolutely,
I'm not going to go. I mean, and probably people who do that most are medical providers themselves.
We definitely are seeing that.
Correct.
They're the worst patients in my experience. But the so I could see it being a very good increase in prevention, and I just think we got to get it right. And I think that you know, I've been around this building for 10 years, and when somebody doesn't want to fund prevention, they say, well, we're moving to global budgets, and you know, it's often a way to kind of put the kibosh on a bill that certain interests don't want to pay for. So I think it needs some tweaking perhaps, but it seems to have some merit to me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And we will be, what I plan to do is I would like to do three or four bills or two bills, I don't know, we'll just have to discuss the very first day, because that very first week, that following last day, the Thursday, we have to be posting work sessions. So that's why I'm so glad that you came and presented to us. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, Tom Holt and Jeanette Holman.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. Just want to say at the outset about this bill, we're very supportive of telehealth, have been for years. We pay for it. You heard two untruths about this bill from the proponents. Untruth number one, quote, insurers do not reimburse for telehealth services. That is not true. I'd be happy to provide to the committee our medical policy that outlines how providers get paid for telehealth. Secondly, you were told it is not a mandate. I think that's a bit laughable. We wouldn't be here talking about a bill if the proponents were not bringing forth a mandate. When we look at what the bill actually does, it does two things in our eyes. It sweeps away standards that were very carefully worked out in large part by participation of the Telehealth Alliance several years ago in collaboration with various, if I recall correctly at the time, the licensing boards, payers, providers, etc. was a large group of people involved. This bill then secondly has a mandate that we reimburse using the same health care service code. Now, what does that really mean? Today, when we pay for telehealth, we get a telehealth code in our system. It's a, you know, we're operating today in a highly automated system of claims processing, so the providers can get paid promptly, and we're able to track you know, well what is happening with our members and, you know, intervene when it is appropriate. If no distinction is made between it being a telehealth service and a normal in-office visit by the code, you know, that removes a very important piece of quality information that we need to know in order to be able to administer our benefits well and do what we need to do on behalf of our members. The other piece that that does, of course, is it means paying for a telehealth service that may be a very, you know, short follow-up at the same level as a full office visit, and that's not appropriate. We think telehealth has a great place in care, especially when it expands capacity expands access. That's been an issue for years in rural areas of specialists having access or patients having access to specialists. And there's a lot of terrific work done in this region of using telehealth to extend those specialty services to areas where they're hard to get to. It's be very appropriate for a physician who has an established relationship with a patient to do a quick follow-up by telehealth and get reimbursed for that appropriately. But here we're talking about an organization that, you know, really is walk-in care, not long-term relationships with people, wanting to run a mandate through here pretty quickly without vetting it properly. We would welcome more in-depth discussion of this issue in the longer interim when there's more time to bring in all the people who ought to be consulted on this. As of mid-December, when I spoke with the proponents and with the Telehealth Alliance, there had not been that kind of broad conversation, so I imagine not much has happened since. If there has been some, there really hasn't been time to vet this properly. So we would strongly suggest holding this over until the longer interim. We'd be delighted to participate in a conversation about, you know, does our telehealth statute, you know, need some updating? You know, we're certainly open to the idea that it may, but we don't think that running something through on short notice on false premises is the way to do it. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson. For the record, my name is Jeanette Holman. I'm a senior policy analyst at the Insurance Division. Senator Cruz asked me to come today to answer questions, and I'd like to start just by a couple of observations about this bill. First of all, I have to reiterate that we do not take positions on these bills, so hopefully my comments will be helpful in your deliberations and telling you some of the issues or things we would like to see tweaked in this bill from the Insurance Division's perspective. We see this bill as expanding telemedicine in a couple of ways. It removes some of the sideboards, and some of those have been mentioned already today. It removes the limitation on the originating site so that you don't have that control of a person being in one medical office calling a specialist in another area or something like that. Again, I'm not sure that's a bad thing to take those off, but it does remove some of the controls over the use of telemedicine. And it also removes the requirement that the service cannot duplicate or supplant a health service already provided or available to the person in person. It also expands telehealth by specifically adding it or extending it to PEB and OEB. The bill does require payment at the same rate as an in-person visit, but there is the opportunity to add a modifier to that CPT code to indicate that it is telemedicine. So I think that's a concern that is addressed in the bill. For the Insurance Division, there's a couple of things that we would ask if you proceed with this bill. You're removing some of the sideboards. If there's areas that you would like us to address in rulemaking to help establish some of the parameters of the use, it would be useful to know that or have it in the bill so that we're not out there going beyond the scope and intent of the legislation or doing something that you really didn't intend, because the message I see with this bill is we want to expand the use of it. And if we're expected to do something to help insurers or the public to use it more effectively, but limit it in any way or establish any kind of standards, that would be nice to have in the legislation itself, just the authority to do that. One thing I would point out is that PEB and OEB are added to the mandate. They're directed to comply with it, but that does not bring them under our enforcement authority. So the I'm not sure who, I guess PEB and OEB would be self-enforcing to a certain extent. Just directing them to comply with this mandate, though, because they're not under the insurance code, wouldn't give us the authority to take enforcement action against them. We do some cooperative, we take consumer advocates, our consumer advocates take calls from PEB and OEB members through just a understanding with those boards, and we forward their concerns on and work with PEB and OEB to get the concerns addressed, but we don't have any hammer or anything else that we can use to enforce if we need to against them. And I think that's about it. I'm happy to answer questions, and I'd be glad to work with folks on this bill if you would like us. Thanks very much.
Senator Cruz?
Jeanette, thank you. And really, really what I'm trying to do is flush out all of the issues, and this, from my perspective, was very helpful to take a look at where we are potentially going with it. There's a lot of positives here if it's done right, and we just want to make sure it's done right. So I wasn't aware of your relationship with PEB and OEBB was that separate. So that's an interesting point. We're going to need to kind of talk about, I think, okay. Madam Chair.
Okay, and one other thing. I know we're way behind, but in my mind, telehealth has already left the station. I mean, and so we are proceeding with telehealth, whether payers want it or not. But I have always envisioned it in a managed care type situation where there's follow-up. And I know with Zoom Care, that is not a managed care environment. Okay. More discussion. Thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it. And finally, LC 168, Tom Holt, do you want to just briefly give us an update on that?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Sanderson, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. You have before you LC 168, which is a technical fix bill to a new mandate that we worked on last session, that in the implementation process we found a couple of things that needed to be fixed. Want to be really clear that we're supportive of the underlying policy that was adopted last session. This is the mandate provides for waiver of cost sharing for pregnant women who have diabetes. And we believe that this is one that actually, in financial terms, pays for itself and is you know, good patient care in the delivery system. What the bill does is just a couple of things. One, it clarifies the scope of the benefit, that it's during the woman's period of pregnancy and ending 6 weeks postpartum. That was discussed as the intent in the bill originally. Just tweak the words a little bit there. And then the second thing it does in terms of the scope of the benefit is clarifies, as was discussed as the intent, that we still would apply in a formulary rules and so on to the benefit. And then the last thing that the bill does, and this is very important and something I wish we had known at the time but discovered through the implementation process as legal experts looked at the implications, we were unintentionally in conflict with the federal health savings account statute and rule, which lay out what a high deductible plan may pay for at a federal level and have the plan still be eligible to have a health savings account paired with it. And unfortunately, the feds do not recognize state decisions around mandates to kind of let their list be flexible over time. It unfortunately is not. So the
other thing the bill does is exempt HSA plans, and that's what you see in Section 1, Paragraph 2, that cross-reference to federal law, simply exempts HSA plans. And that's important because if we don't do that, then we put at risk the qualification of the special tax status of health savings accounts for Oregonians. And to put in some perspective, and those who do buy those products already have made the decision to have a number of things be out-of-pocket costs before they actually start using their insurance benefits. So, again, this is not intended, and we don't think it does in any way change the underlying policy of what we all intended to do in the last session, and just fixes the language so that we can administer this benefit as best we can going forward.
Great. Senator Steiner-Hubert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Holt, I just want to say thank you to you and other members of the insurance industry for the work that you've put into implementing this in the past year as one of the co-chief sponsors of the bill last session. I do have one question for you. I'm a little bit troubled. I'm having trouble interpreting the last three lines of the bill, lines 2 through 4 on page 2. It says the plan may be exempt from the requirements of subsection 1 of this section until after a reasonable period of time designated by the insurer following such notification. So imagine for a minute that I'm pregnant. At 50, I darn well better not be. But imagine for a minute I'm pregnant and I've got diabetes, right? And I go to my doctor for I get in early for health care at 6 weeks, and so far my sugars are fine. But at 12 weeks, she starts telling me, look, you got to start checking more, and my costs are going to go up. And you get the bill for that as my insurer. And you say, sorry, Mrs. Hayward, you need to provide us with proof. And until you do, and until 30 days after that, we're not covering. So I've got a month and a half of extra costs that should be covered, if I'm interpreting this language correctly. Help me out here.
Sure.
There's no retroactive.
Yeah, piece? Chair Miles Anderson, Senator Hayward. Now, the benefit would be from, as specified in the bill, from the time we get notified. That's just recognizing there's going to be, probably some gaps, and what we want to be able to do is say, look, you need to tell us about this. So if we don't know, we can't provide the benefit. So from an implementation standpoint, it's important for us to be able to just have a time, time by when you need to let us know what's going on so that we can then provide the benefit as intended. I wouldn't see it at all playing out in the kind of scenario that you described, and we certainly would be supportive of addressing that in rulemaking.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. I would like to open a work session on the introduction of committee measures.
Madam Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 147, dated 1/15/14; LC 148, dated 1/13/14; and LC 168, dated 12/19/13.
Okay, Senator Cruz has moved that the following LCs be introduced, as he stated: LC 147, LC 148, and LC 168. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
That's how quick the bills will go in February.
Yeah. I'll close the work session, and we'll return to informational hearing, and I would like to call Bruce Goldberg. Amy, are you coming too? Up to talk to us about Cover Oregon.
Got three of us, if that's okay.
Yes.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg. I am the interim executive director of Cover Oregon. With me are Amy Favre and Aaron Cardula. Since last time you were here, Rocky King, who was the executive director of Cover Oregon, has resigned. I am on leave from the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm now the interim executive director of Cover Oregon, and here today to give you an update as to where we are. I thought I would try and cover three things at a high level, and then open it up for questions. Those three things are where we are with the website and the technology. Secondly, where we are with enrollment, and I think that the third I would put in the heading of future sustainability, future contingency plans, et cetera. So. In terms of an update on the technology and where we are on the website, it's no secret to everybody on the committee that we do not have a functioning website that enrolls people from end to end. That is not where we anticipated to be today. We are enrolling people. We enroll them through a process which entails both some manual as well as some use of the web and IT technology. We are able to have individuals who can apply online, but then that has to be manually entered into the information system. The information system can determine eligibility, but then we need to get the information about eligibility back to people, and then they can enroll online. It is not an easy process. It's been difficult. It's been frustrating for consumers around the state. It's a process that is certainly a contingency. We didn't anticipate being here. We know it's been difficult for consumers. The process is getting better every day as we continue to make improvements in the workflow, the ability to process applications more rapidly. And our goal is to continue to make that a better process. I don't want to put too rosy a picture on it. Having said that, we have been able to enroll individuals, and our enrollment numbers, which I'll get to in a minute, are aligning with those of other states around the country. In terms of the website and our ability to get it functional, when I began in Cover Oregon in December, we had identified 48 critical problems which needed to get fixed in the system. Those were 48 things that would give us the ability to have individuals enroll end to end with Cover Oregon. We are now down to 13. And the way that the IT development process works is that the IT and system developers write the code. It then gets tested. Based on those tests, it is very common almost all the time. It has to be retested, redone, additional fixes made, retested through, at a minimum, 3 test cycles to then when something is accurate enough and good enough to be utilized. We've been making our way. Oracle has been making its way through that process. I think we're at a critical point in the project now where over the next few weeks, Oracle is entering into some intense testing on key areas of the system. And when that's completed over the next couple of weeks, I think we will have a much better sense of whether we're going to have a functioning website available during open enrollment or whether we won't. I'd like to cover a couple of things about that. One is what we're doing in terms of working with our current contractor, Oracle, and two, around contingency plans. I think, as you know, Oracle is our technology vendor. We've been relying on them to build a functioning system. We've made a large investment in that. We're working collaboratively with them to get a fully functional website. At the same time, everyone, including Oracle and all of you and everyone in the state, is aware that it's not working. We don't have the end-to-end functionality and ability to enroll people that we contracted for. And until we have that, further payment is contingent upon having a functioning website. We currently have about a little bit more than $20 million that are contingent upon having a functioning website. Taken a number of other actions in terms of getting some outside legal assistance to look at what our options are under the contract, to hold them accountable. When you've been briefed in the past, you've been told that some of the issues were that the code that's being written and the system function weren't good enough, that some of the code was deficient. Have brought in two experts on system function and on code writing to be able to examine that code and be able to help assure that it's of the quality that will allow us to have a good system. Have also brought in some experts to make sure that we've got the appropriate systems in place to be able to go live should all these problems get worked out over the next several weeks. Lastly, I think as many of you know, I have Greg Van Pelt working with me to help with both us putting together our organization as well as advising about the project as having run large health systems, large insurance company. In terms of the future and contingency, I think that it's prudent that we begin to plan for the future. As I indicated, if we're able to go through this next couple of weeks of testing and, you know, it's successful, then certainly there's the potential to have a functional website for open enrollment. But in case we get to the point where we believe that doesn't become fully functional, then I think it's only prudent that we begin to look at other alternatives. And as a result, we will begin to look at what other alternatives are available. As I indicated, we've made a large investment in the technology. Some of the technology is working. And so the questions are several. Can we take some of the existing technology and leverage what's working and combine that with what are some other existing systems, whether that be from other states or the federal government? Or is it possible to look at other existing enrollment systems and utilize those? I don't think that we are at that point yet. But I believe that in the near future, we will be approaching that. That brings me to where we are with enrollment.
Madam Chair, if we could, before you leave that subject.
Sure.
Some things I've been curious about, for example, I mean, you contract with Oracle, you gave them this task. How many program changes did you hit them with in the course of all of this? Because to a large degree, what you're doing is saying hit that target and then you keep moving it. So is there some way we could kind of get a sense of how fluid this was all through, keeping in mind that up until a few months ago, we were told everything was wonderful, but I know there had to be program changes just because that's the nature of the beast. So if we could get kind of a sense of how that dynamic played out, that would be helpful.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, members of the committee, indeed, that as this was being developed over the past couple of years, as federal policy changed, as business requirements changed, there were a number of changes that were put in to say, now we'd like this built, but hasn't been contemplated before, or a different and an additional business requirement. One of the issues that I've been working with the Oracle team team on over the last 6 weeks has been that at this point in the project, you have to lock down scope. You can't be making changes, and you have to be able to have some discipline in terms of being able to say, if we're going to have a functional system in the near future, it's got to be based on these criteria. Other additional fixes, other additional functionality that you might like, some additional things have to come later. So things like we've stopped development on the shop, the small business exchange, that will come after the individual market. I think Aaron can probably give you a little bit more of a sense of the quantity of changes that have gone on in the past, but certainly that's a common issue in project development. I can say right now we are working very closely to be certain we lock down scope, have no more changes, and have a clear agreement on what's being built and when it's going to be delivered.
Okay, and Tudor, I mean, our vision was incredibly large, incredibly sophisticated. You know, this is going to serve many masters, basically, rather than just serving the one master should have been designed to serve. And so I'm just if that's what you're kind of doing is shrinking it back down to, we're supposed to develop a market. Okay, which was the original intent. And then I think it grew beyond its original intent, and that may have been part of the problem. I'm just guessing. I'm just a farm boy. I don't understand this technological stuff.
I think scope is one of the issues that continues to be addressed in any large IT project. And I think as we, you know, Senator Cruz, I think as you know right now, my focus has been on a couple things. One, it's been getting the website operational, and number two, it's been enrollment and improving the communication and function of the organization. Having said that, I think that there's going to be an opportunity. I know that the governor has putting in place an outside independent review to, I think, look at a lot of those issues, some of which you've alluded to, and I think that there'll be others to see what it is we can learn from in terms of why we are where we are today, which is not where any of us had wanted to be, nor where we should be.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, if I could. One, how much is the independent review going to cost? And two, how much money have you held back from Oracle at this point?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Shields, members of the committee, I do not know how much the independent review is going to cost. That's being run out of DAS and the governor's office, and I'm sure that they can get you that info.
The second one was how much are you withheld from Oracle?
Thank you. We've withheld over $20 million at this point.
I
think I indicated, you may have been out of the room, you know, further payment is being withheld contingent upon delivery of a functioning system.
Madam Chair, or to committee staff, could we get some more detail on the independent review? Whose budget is it coming from? How much? I'd also be interested in the process for selection of this independent group, and you know whether or not do they have other dogs in the fight in state government, or is this the only contract they're ever going to have with us? I'd like to know a little bit more.
Madam Chair, that would be good information. I would suggest we might be slightly premature. I don't know that they've fully established scope yet at this point.
There is an executed contract, okay. So I think people can get you that information.
Senator Knoop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Goldberg, you're obviously a very smart guy.
If I were, I might not be in this role.
Well, I kind of wanted to ask you what you did to the governor to have him appoint you as the interim director of Cover Oregon, but I'm guessing it's just because you're really smart. Can you tell me, as it relates to the scope, who, what group, what individual made the decision to pursue the scope that Oregon did in the first place?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Knopf, members of the committee. Years ago, I think it's dating back to about 2011, 2012, the Oregon Health Authority, the legislature, the groups that were all working, the Health Policy Board, that were all looking at the development of this website, looked at it in conjunction with, there was a Medicaid modernization project beginning to go on in the Department of Human Services, and I think that we saw an opportunity to be able to combine a single door for Medicaid, for the individual market, for the small group market, and look at how we could leverage some of the work that had begun in the state on improving the eligibility system for other federal programs. So it came through a combination of the Oregon Health Authority, Department of Human Services, working in conjunction with some other policymakers in the state. And I think one of the issues is the implementation of that vision and that scope, and I think since having that vision, I think one of the issues, as I just indicated, has been the ability to deliver all of that at the same time, and probably more appropriately, and I think this is one of the issues for the independent review to look at, is how the decision making was made as when and how to adjust scope. We've begun to adjust scope clearly over the last 3-4 months, but that wasn't sufficient to be able to bring us operational on October 1.
Just a follow-up question. Sometimes we hear people refer to the $300 million website. I think most of us recognize it's not a $300 million website. Can you tell us exactly how much we spent as of December 31 of this year on the website itself?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Knopf, members of the committee, I misquoted a dollar figure at the last committee hearing. And I don't think I'm as smart as you think I am. But one thing I do try and do is not repeat a mistake twice. And no, in all seriousness, I'll get you that information. I don't have it at the tip of my tongue. I misquoted what we had spent, what we had paid Oracle. But we can provide you with a complete dollar figure. The project is being paid for through 2014 on federal funding. Right. We've had two grants. We've spent a significant amount of dollars up through today. I believe there's well over $100 million still budgeted for the rest of this biennium through that federal grant. We need to be off that federal grant and sustainable in 2015, and I will have that for you. The dollars aren't just for a website. They're for customer service. It's been for outreach and enrollment. It's been for marketing, and we can break out all of the expenses. But certainly, it's been a substantial investment in the technology to enroll people.
So, follow-up question to that. So, obviously, the website hasn't enrolled anybody. We all know that. And so we're using individuals to collect that information. Reports have gotten back to us, anecdotal as they might be, that the folks who are either on the phones or enrolling people that they have been essentially trying to steer people to different plans, and maybe they don't have that particular education or ability to do so. Have you heard those reports? Are they true? And have we hired high schoolers to do this work, as has been reported in different places that has gotten back to us? So,
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Knope, members of the committee, couple of issues there. One is, have I heard of issues around either inaccurate information or people steering people in the wrong way? Yes, I've heard of that. When I hear of it, whenever we hear that, we investigate those. If there are errors being made or staff are behaving in a way that's outside of the expectations and training, actions are taken. We strive to be as accurate as possible. We have hired a large number of people, close to 400 people between the Oregon Health Authority and Cover Oregon, to work through this manual enrollment process. This was a new process, as I think you can imagine. And so it's not as if on day one we had a group of seasoned experts where we brought another 30 people in and they had the luxury of being able to learn from that. It's been a difficult process. I couldn't sit before you and say that there haven't been errors made. I can tell you that the process continues to get smoother and to get better. Everybody goes through training. There's a training procedure. There's people have to be trained and aware of issues around confidentiality, job expectations. Everybody goes through a security check around the issues of hiring high school students. Everybody that gets hired is hired under the same hiring criteria as would be for any state job, have to meet the same requirements, the same age and background check and all of those training requirements. There has been some outreach to community college programs, as well as a couple of special high school programs that are career development, get people trained kind of programs. There have been some individuals hired out of those. Those individuals have met the same criteria as they would if they had come applying for a job off of the street.
So we did hire high schoolers, but not predominantly.
Correct.
So a small percentage of the
400. I can get you the percentage. I don't have it off the top of my head, but that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
You made a statement. I'm not quite sure. You said the same criteria for any state job. There are a lot of state jobs where you have to have a certain level of education to even apply. Okay.
Correct.
And this one, what is the level of education required to apply for this job?
The same level. Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, members of the committee, my apologies. Same level as anybody else who would come in and apply for that job. So, in other words, the job has particular I don't know what the exact education criteria were, but there's clearly criteria. They met the same criteria as everybody met for that job.
For that job, yeah
exactly.
But
correct. There are different criteria, different degrees for different jobs.
Okay. It would be interesting to know. I mean, would a GED qualify, or if they don't even have that, do they qualify? It'd be interesting to know that.
We can get you the criteria which were established, and all individuals met the same criteria.
Okay. That would be helpful.
Where are the funds coming from on a monthly basis to pay for the extra 400 people? And I've heard the number $7 million a month. Can you enlighten me on...
This is one I can give you numbers on.
Excellent.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Knope, members of the committee, We've spent approximately $3.3 million to date, to I believe it's about January 1, on hiring it's approximately 400 additional individuals to process the applications. That has come from two places. $1.8 million is out of the Oregon Health Authority budget, and $1.5 million out of the Cover Oregon budget, making my math add up to 3.3. In the Cover Oregon, so the $1.5 million in the Cover Oregon budget that we're going to do from the existing federal grant, that's going to mean rebalancing our budget, looking at taking reductions elsewhere in the budget to be able to cover that expense, so no additional dollars are being requested on top of that. On the health authority budget, there were dollars budgeted in the health authority budget for Medicaid enrollment to enroll all of the individuals that were coming in through the Medicaid expansion. When I get to the enrollment side, we've enrolled 42,000 people into Medicaid through the Cover Oregon, this application process. So some of those, that $1.8 million is helping to pay for that. The Oregon Health Authority has some of the dollars that they budgeted for enrollment. They have some savings because of, at the same time, we instituted the fast-track enrollment process. So they've enrolled 114,000 people to date through the fast track process. Individuals that have already qualified for SNAP at the federal level are able to, since they've pre-qualified, are able to not have to go through an entire application process. So there's been some increased savings on that enrollment, and those are where the dollars are coming from.
Okay.
Just these navigators you're hiring, I'm trying to figure out, and some you've direct hired, some you've hired from agencies. I mean, it's a real mix. But I also heard that these were all part-time positions, or are they full-time positions?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, members of the committee, they're not permanent positions.
I understand, yeah. But are they 40 hours, 20 hours?
Some are 40 hours, some are 40 hours plus in individuals. Okay. We're operating two 10, 11-hour shifts, seven days a week. A lot of the individuals, it's a 40-hour work week, but a lot of these individuals are happy to have a job. I've talked to a lot of them. I was surprised that on we ran a shift on Christmas night, and there were a lot of individuals who were very happy to come in and work that night to have the hours. So I mean, there are a lot of people out who are looking for employment, and this has provided employment for those individuals. But these are not permanent positions. These positions will go away when we're able to enroll people on the web and no longer need to have that kind of a workforce.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. The rumor I'd heard that these were all 20-hour positions, and I'm thinking, okay, so thanks for clearing that up.
Let me go through on the having sort of, I think we've naturally transitioned into where we are with in enrollment, and this gives you a very high-level summary, and let me try and walk through that. We've had approximately, it's a little over 180,000 people today enrolled into coverage that began January 1. And let me break out where that's from. You know, approximately 160,000 are Oregon Health Plan. And those 160,000 Oregon Health Plan have come from two places. 118,000 have come in through the fast track process that I just mentioned, and 42,000 have come in through Cover Oregon. So these are individuals who have filled out the same application as anybody else, come in through the system, and they're determined eligible for Medicaid. So 160,000 into Medicaid. We have, through Cover Oregon, enrolled 65,000 people. Those are the 42,000 people that I indicated have come into Medicaid. And we've enrolled upwards of 20,000. We're close to 23,000 today that are going into the commercial market. In addition, there's a figure here of 95,000. In addition to the 65,000 who have moved on, either they've been entered into the Medicaid information system or they've gone over to the carriers, there's approximately another 30,000 people that have come through Cover Oregon. We've determined them eligible for the commercial market. They have all the information that they have to enroll in a plan, but they've chosen not to at this point. And we believe that's for a couple of different reasons. One, everybody in the individual market except for OMIP and Portability have had their individual plans extended through March. So there were a number of individuals who applied in November and early December thinking that their insurance would end on January 1. They were had individual coverage. And now every insurer has extended through March 31st. Some insurers have extended beyond that for the whole year. And so some of those people, we believe, are individuals who now have much more of a luxury of taking some time to make a choice. Others are individuals who, for economic reasons, have chosen not to enroll today. They may enroll in February or in March. Others, one of the things about the Oregon market is we've got a very good market. We have 11 plans. It's been very competitive. Plans have competed against each other for price. That's been a good thing. It's also meant that there's been a lot of consumer choice, and that's what we're hearing from individuals. There's 11 carriers. There's over 100 plans for people to choose from. So 11 carriers, but some carriers have 5, 6, 7 different plans at the silver, bronze, and gold level. So it's a lot of choice for consumers, and it's taking them some time to work through that. So that's where we are with in enrollment to date. I think our enrollment numbers are starting to align with other states that either have their own state exchanges or in the federal exchange. We're about in the middle of the pack. On this sheet are some of the actions we've taken to really bring up what's been a huge effort in enrolling people, not what we anticipated in the beginning of this process. And that kind of brings me to the last piece of this, which is...
Before you move to your last piece, this came from Senator Farioli's office. In summary, basically he mentions, there have been, over 20,000 individuals have obtained private coverage. However, nearly 30,000 individuals received eligibility and enrollment information but have chosen not to enroll.
Correct.
And so he was saying if Oregon desires to continue its work at the vanguard of health care reform, it must understand why over 60% of the individuals who have access to new plans through Cover Oregon are choosing not to enroll. And he is requesting us, the committee, to ask you and the OHA to conduct information gathering regarding why individuals who are eligible for coverage through Cover Oregon are not enrolling. Now, will you be doing that or not?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, and members of the committee, you've just asked us to do it. So indeed, we'll be doing that. But anecdotally, no, I think this is an important piece. Yes, we will be doing that moving forward. We have some anecdotal information, as I alluded to. I think it's a number of things. One, it's been a change in the market that people now have additional time to make a choice. Two, it's been that there's a lot of choice. I think three, there have been some personal economic factors. Four, I would say there are certainly issues about consumer confidence and in Cover Oregon. And I think concern about enrolling in something that, you know, from their vantage point is not working at this point. So I think it's a lot of information, and it is appropriate because it does actually get at this next piece, which is sustainability and why people have or have not enrolled. I mean, we will have much better information at the end of open enrollment. And I think that's going to be when we'll be able to get better information. Right now, we're just, people still have through March. So the issue, I think, and not to paraphrase the question, but it's really not why haven't they enrolled today. But the issue is going to be by the end of March, why haven't people,
right,
if they have all the information, why have they or have they not enrolled? That's going to be an important question because the issue in the long run is going to be about sustainability.
Yeah, Senator Hayward.
Thank you very much, Chairman Sanderson. You know, I appreciate Senator Ferriola's concern, and I would agree. And I asked Ms. Edlin earlier today at the Human Services Subcommittee the same question about the Medicaid automatic fast-track eligibility, people who hadn't enrolled. I think that's important information to get. Your point, Dr. Goldberg, that we won't really know how many people have chosen not to enroll until after March 31st, I think is an important one. And frankly, although I agree that ultimately we need that information in terms of sustainability about why people choose not to enroll either in commercial or Medicaid, I really hope that we don't divert efforts from fixing the enrollment system toward getting information with enormous respect and agreement with my colleague, Senator Ferrioli, that it's important information to get. I just want to go on record as saying, first things first, let's get the damn thing fixed, and then we'll figure it out about why people aren't engaging.
My focus right now is on two things, well, three things. It's certainly on getting the website fixed. It's been on getting people enrolled, and it's been really about improving communication and the consumer experience. And that's what we've been focused on and are working towards. You have in your possession some enrollment projections that really get at, I think, some of the questions here. And Cover Oregon had done enrollment projections, a year or two ago, based on some national modeling. It's how the business plan was put together. In early December, these enrollment projections were revised, and they were revised for a couple of reasons that we've just discussed. They were revised because the website wasn't working and there were issues with consumer confidence. And they were revised because the market had changed. Now there's a significant number of people who will have individual coverage extended through the entire year and everybody through March. So the enrollment projections were revised. There's a key word in this, and it's the P word, projection. I think we're in new territory, and these are only projections, but we've been using these to look at a couple of things, and it gets at future sustainability. So one is the sustainability of Cover Oregon, and the other is as an organization, and the other is the individual market. I think that's a couple of the questions that Senator Ferrioli was alluding to. In terms of the sustainability of Cover Oregon, as I indicated, Cover Oregon needs to sustain itself based on it's currently a $9.30-plus administrative fee, which is built into the rate right now. And the Cover Oregon needs to sustain itself on that out into 2015. We're currently putting together a budget to start to look at. I mean, there's two sides to putting together a budget. One is revenue, and the other is expenses. And what I've asked the organization to do is to not look at increasing the assessment, but to rather look at, can we rebudget to reduce our expenditures commensurate with lower enrollment, and is that going to be possible to do? And we're working on that. I am optimistic that we can reduce expenditures at the approximate 20% level that would be able make us able to operate from a budget perspective out in 2015 at the new low enrollment level, as well as at staff are preparing an even lower, a very low floor in enrollment projection. And so we're working on that, and I know we'll be bringing that back to the legislature, bring it back to the board. I've discussed it with the Legislative Oversight Committee. But the other piece of the market is also then about the insurance market itself. Who's signing up? Are we getting young, healthy individuals, or have the 20,000 people we've signed up all bald and over the hill like myself? And I think those are really important questions. What does the market look like? We don't have that information today. I think that's part of not having a functioning website, is I can't give you real-time eligibility on the demographics of the 20-plus thousand people that have enrolled. We'll be getting that out into the future. But that's some of the information that we're going to need as we continue to plan out into the future. And, again, we'll have our there's really going to be two key points. One is going to be in April. I mean, in April, we'll have a sense of who's come in between now and the end of open enrollment. And then the other piece will be November, December, because there is a number of people, and we'll be able to, I believe, get a handle on that from the carriers, of the numbers of individuals that have extended coverage for a year. And then there'll be another open enrollment period in November, December, and it's the number that come in then, as well as our ability to get the small group up and going. That's some of what these enrollment projections include, having the shop exchange up and operational in about 6 months, not today, but out into the future. And so we'll see if we can do that. And obviously a lot more information to come as we move forward. So we're certainly right now in a contingency mode. We have a process to enroll people that includes a combination of both using parts of the technology as well as some manual work. We are working with Oracle to fix the remaining problems in the system to have an end-to-end enrollment. The next several weeks will be critical in terms of some intense testing that's going on to clear those remaining 13 deficits and assure that we have a system that operates at the performance standards, 10,000 users at any time, et cetera, to be able to work. After the end of the next couple weeks, we'll have a better sense of our ability to have a usable system for open enrollment. At the same time, we're beginning to start to look at the kinds of contingencies that we might have to have out into the future as we don't, and are beginning to start to talk about some of the issues around the market and enrollment that we're all going to need. We know it's been a difficult process. It's been really difficult for consumers. It's been extremely difficult for carriers, for agents, for everybody involved in this. Carriers have been great. They've been flexible. We've had multiple dates and time frames changed. We've been working together. Agents have been very accommodating. The public's had an enormous amount of patience. Some people have been able to enroll through the system easily. Others have had a very, very difficult time. We're working on getting it better every day. We continue to make progress. And I think the next month is obviously going to be a very critical time in both how we operationalize and how we develop this. And there will be certainly a lot more to come.
Gwyneth, thank you very much, all of you. I mean, all of us I know are so disappointed where we were leading and now we're not leading.
Correct.
Just an aside and then your question. Payers or insurers have to start going through another rate review process, right?
Correct. It begins in that process begins again in, I believe it's April.
April. Is that going to screw up the website when new numbers come up?
Chair Mona Anderson, Senator Cruz, members of the committee, no, it's actually just the opposite. It's more the fact that there's so much uncertainty in the market right now is going to create, I think, a lot of challenges for people as they put together rates in the spring. But the technology has enough of its own challenges that it doesn't need any more from the rate review process and won't have any from that. It operates independently.
Right,
Madam Chair, I would think plugging those, that's just plugging numbers in at that point because they go through rate case every year. And so it's just a matter of plugging numbers. Before I get to my question, I do want to point out that it was a doctor on this committee that called it that damn thing. So I just thought I'd point that out. And
we've learned that in medical school.
Okay. See,
technical talk that we don't expect lay people to understand.
Okay,
Senator.
I understand. Trust me, farmers have some technical terms as well.
I'm sure
so,
you do.
A couple questions, Bruce. We've heard mixed anecdotal stories relative to the federal subsidies for those who have qualified, that for some reasons we kind of are low end from other states on that. I mean, what's the reality of the federal subsidies?
Chair Mona Anderson, Senator Cruz, members of the committee, we are, because our insurance rate, the premium rates are lower than in many other states, the subsidy rate is lower as well.
Okay.
Because it's based on a total out-of-pocket expenditure. So in a state that, just broadly, if the premium were twice as expensive for the same plan in another state,
they get twice as much.
You would get twice as large of a subsidy.
Okay.
So that in that state you would pay out of pocket at that same income level the same as someone in Oregon.
Okay.
So that is correct. Our subsidies are lower.
Okay. And the other thing, Madam Chair, at this point in time, because I could go on and on and on, and it's getting late. Your oversight committee, Senator Boquist, asked a series of questions, and which you are going to respond to. I would appreciate if we, in this committee, get those responses as well, because they're really good questions. So
if they could be sent to committee staff.
Yeah, we will. Happy to do that.
Okay.
Senator Knope.
Yeah, I don't want to delay your adjournment, Madam Chair, but my concern is more around what's going to happen to the rates in April. The insurance companies will have an experience. I think they were projected or promised to have many more enrollees than they probably will. I don't know if you have the data on age, but I suspect that what we're not going to see is Young Invincibles at 35 or 40% of the enrollments. We're probably going to see the old guys like us and the unhealthy at probably a higher rate. And so that likely is going to translate into higher rates than there are today. Now, the biggest complaint I hear about Cover Oregon isn't about a non-working website. It's about the fact that the coverage isn't really coverage at all because it costs twice as much, the deductibles are twice as much, and in order for them to get coverage, they, while it may be better on in some areas in terms of the coverage, they have to pay so much up front through that deductible process and through their monthly payments that they can't afford it. So it really doesn't matter if theoretically it's better coverage if they can't afford it. And I've heard that from 30-year-old people. I've heard that from people in their mid-50s. And it seems to be relatively universal. Now, we signed up a bunch of people that are getting health care for free, and we didn't seem to have a problem getting them signed up. They seem to like that idea. I understand why.
Correct.
But what, I mean, I guess I'm looking for some assurance from you that we're not going to be sitting here in 2015 hearing that we're going to have to spend X millions of dollars to subsidize Cover Oregon in order to keep it going because some of my colleagues promised all-day kindergarten a few years ago, but hasn't been paid for yet either. And I'm sure there's other things that we're going to need to be paying for as well. Are you confident that you're going to be able to continue the program without significant subsidy from the general fund or some new revenue source?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Canope, members of the committee, well, one of the things I've learned through this whole process is there haven't been a lot of assurances about anything. We've seen a number of deadlines come and go. So just with that as a backdrop, I believe that at the low at a low or very low in enrollment, that we will be able to sustain an infrastructure in Cover Oregon based on the current assessment levels and will not need additional general fund from the legislature. I've taken a look at the budget. I will say it's not the kind of detailed look that I would want to have to look you in the eye and give you an 100% assurance, but I do believe that at the low and very low in enrollments, that indeed Cover Oregon will be sustainable. Having said that, I don't know what enrollment is going to be over the next 6 months, and I think I can have a better sense of that after March as we go through some of this. And I think these are the exact right questions. I think like any question, we've got to get the right data to answer it. And I think we're going to have much better data when we get out past open in enrollment. And so I'm not in any way trying to not answer your question. I just think it's the appropriate question. I think it needs to be answered. I think we will have much better information to give you a more confident answer as we get more information out into the spring. And indeed, these are some of the very same questions that Senator Boquist has asked and the Oversight Committee. And we're putting together a work plan to work through some of that because I think people understand and the legislators on the Oversight Committee have understood that we're in a very different spot than we were 6 months ago, and we need to get some additional information, and then I can come back and provide some greater assurance to the general answer that I've just given you today.
I think that we need to keep the overall picture in mind. The goal is to get Oregonians enrolled, and we have done that. I mean, we have many more, thousands and thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands, 180,000 enrolled. And this long-term is going to make a huge difference because we know better health outcomes come when you have health insurance.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think change is so difficult, and I think we knew there were going to be some glitches, and we've definitely had, I think, more than our fair share, but change sometimes is a rough road, and I'm truly optimistic that this is the right thing to do. It's just that I just wish it hadn't been such a rocky road.
Madam Chair, I appreciate what you said, but I'd also say that because the majority of that 180,000 were enrolled in Medicaid, which somebody else is paying for, it does beg the question whether the cost shift is sustainable long term. I mean, it that is a real issue.
But it's still ultimate goal to we need people to be covered. Yeah.
I know it's late, but I do think it's important to point out that we're actually conflating two very separate issues here, or more accurately, three or four. There's the issue of a functional website, which allows people to enroll in a wide range of health plans, both commercial and government-sponsored. There's the issue of educating people so that they can make informed choices. There's the issue of our economy, where we're still coming out of a fairly deep recession, which means that our Medicaid population is much higher than all of us hope it will be 2 years from now when our federal subsidy for Medicaid starts to diminish substantially. The issue of rate review and rate setting, we need our colleagues from the insurance division to be working with us on that, and we need to be having some very frank conversations with our colleagues in the insurance industry about how do we make sure that they, because they are mostly for-profit businesses and we respect that, or, you know, not-for-profit in different ways, that we work with them and we don't ask them to be shooting in the dark, but on the other hand, that they don't go off the deep end this year and put in wildly inflated estimates because they don't have the data, because they don't have the enrollment thing. We've got a lot of pieces here. And it's very important that we tease them apart so that we think really carefully about which pieces the legislature can interact with whom do we need to interact to affect those pieces, and how do we think about this not just between now and March 31st or December 31st or December 31st of 2015, but what does the trajectory look like over the next 5 years? Because those are all important questions. And I'm not trying to speechify, but I do think people have brought up some really important points, and it's important to tease them apart a little bit.
The economy is recovering?
Right? At some level, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Any further discussion? Thank you so much.
It's getting better.
We are with you. We want you to succeed. We, as a state, need to succeed. So thank you again.
Thank you.
All right, with that, we're adjourned. All right, with that, we're adjourned.